All right, if you take your Bibles once again and turn to Exodus chapter 20. And as I do, as you do, I thought I'd share with you something I just recently received over the email that kind of fits in or would be a somewhat of a good lead in to where we're going this morning. There was a man who had finally got around to taking in all of his broken umbrellas to the repair shop. The next morning on his way to his office, when he got up to leave from the street car, he absentmindedly laid hold of the umbrella next to him belonging to a woman who was sitting next to him, and the one that because he had always had the habit of carrying one along with him, and so he just, without thinking about it, grabbed her umbrella and started to walk off with it. And the woman cried, "Stop, thief, thief," as loud as she could, and of course totally embarrassed the man to no end. Well, the same day he stopped by the repair shop and received all 8 of his umbrellas that had now been fixed. And as he entered the streetcar with the unwrapped umbrellas tucked under his arm, he was horrified beholding the glaring same woman who was glaring at him in the light of that morning's misadventure. And her voice came to him charged with a withering scorn, and she said, "Had a good day, didn't you?" Well, again, not necessarily. Right now, Linda laughed at the joke, and my children are laughing at Linda. Well, the point of that story is not everything that appears to be theft necessarily is. On the other hand, and more importantly, there's a whole lot today that's not considered theft, that indeed is. And this has happened because when men reject Yahweh's moral laws, our only authentic, or you might say bona fide, or absolute moral yardstick or guideline for our lives, they have the propensity to make legal what's unlawful, even when it comes to theft and other things of that nature. In fact, such is inevitable because all vacuums are eventually filled with surrogates. And in this instance, with a far, far inferior replacement, because Yahweh's perfection, isn't that what His law is called? My laws are perfect. And in this case, it's Yahweh's perfection that's replaced with man's imperfection. No matter how good it is, it's still imperfect. And we're not even close to the perfect side of imperfection. This will be the 8th commandment, part 10. Based, of course, upon Exodus chapter 20, 15 and Deuteronomy 5, 19 that says simply, "Thou shall not steal." Now, I want to just briefly, as we get into this next message, I want to briefly revisit the 8th commandment statute we discussed in last week's message. That statute which I identified as the lost and found statute, or we could also call it your brother's keeper statute, that requires us to be a guardian of both our brother and his property, or our neighbor and his property, or even those who may not even be an acquaintance, and even to the extent of even our enemies as well. Now, it's clear from that statute and other Bible passages that it's the duty of every able-bodied man to come to the aid and or defense as might be required of any brother or sister, neighbor, acquaintance, or otherwise when such is required. And I think that most people haven't realized that that is a duty, a responsibility, according to God's laws, that every able-bodied man is required himself to be ready to come to the aid of his brother to protect him and or his possessions. And that, men, once again, does not mean calling 911, except for possible backup. Some men think that that's the sum total of their responsibility. That's our society has grown to the place where most men don't even think about being their neighbor's guardian, but that if there is a situation, that their only requirement is to grab that cell phone and call 911. But not only are the police not likely to respond in time, but I've been told that with some of today's police forces, that they don't consider it their responsibility to intervene or to stop crime even in the first place. And in fact, the shootings 5 years ago at Columbine High School prove the point. If you know the story and what the police did in that situation, they did not consider it their responsibility to go in that building and stop what was happening. And of course, as a result, many, I don't know how many there were, 18 was it, or more than that, that were actually killed, and many more shot in that particular instance. The police don't consider their responsibility. The men on the police force should. And every other man who was within close enough distance to respond to that situation. However, if you're going to call the police or 911, here's the way to do it. This is from what I understand as a true story, and it's been entitled How to Call the Police. George Phillips of Meridian, Mississippi, was going up to bed when his wife told him that he had left the light on in the garden shed, which he could see from the bedroom window. George opened the back door to go turn off the light, but saw that there were people in the shed stealing things. He phoned the police, who asked, "Is someone in your house?" And he said, "No." Then they said that all the patrols were busy and that he should simply lock his door and an officer would be along when available. George said, "Okay," hung up, counted to 30, and phoned the police again. "Hello? I just called you a few seconds ago because there were people in my shed. Well, you don't have to worry about them now because I've just shot them all." Then he hung up. Within 5 minutes, three police cars, an armed response unit, and an ambulance showed up at the Phillips residence. Of course, the police caught the burglars in the act. One of the policemen said to George, "I thought you said that you'd shot them." George said, I thought you'd said there was nobody available." If it wasn't, if it's not a true story, it should be. Now, men, once again, listen to me. Our duty, our responsibility is not to call 911, or 911, excuse me. Ours, according to those statutes that we looked at in the last message, in the other passages that we looked at, ours is to be minutemen, ever vigilant. You might think about where that word leads. We'll talk about it a little bit more. But ever vigilant and ready to guard, protect, or deliver our neighbor and his goods at any given time. And men, you need to prepare. Let me tell you something. You need to prepare your minds now to do so. In fact, I do this from time to time. I rehearse situations in case I'm ever caught and found in a situation where something is occurring at the time. I rehearse what my reaction would be to that, or what it should be to that. Now, if you're like me, don't depend on your dreams. You can never get to the weapon. Your fist can never fly through the air. You've been through that. I dream those things, and we're being assaulted or something, and I just, you've got no weapons available, and I just can't get my arms to go. So my family knows, Linda knows what I do is I snort at them. She thinks I'm snoring. I'm just snorting at the guy because that's the best I can do. Well, I say rehearse. Forget about the dreams and rehearse. Prepare yourselves because we're no longer the nation of men that we used to be, who were once men, ready, ever vigilant to respond to whatever was necessary. Or because if you don't, it's very possible that when the time comes for action, that you may not respond as you should. And so rehearse it and think about it and prepare yourselves to be ready at any given time. And again, if our society, as I pointed out in the last message, if our society, think about this, if our society was governed by that rule or that statute alone, and our nation was replete with such men, if it were therefore not a question to any potential thief, rapist, or murderer, or any other lowlife for that matter, that at any given moment that every Christian man within hearing or within sight of the crime of sin is a vigilante, and that's what God intends us to be, at least to a certain extent, a person standing vigilant and ready at a moment's to do whatever is required to stop the perpetrator in his tracks. Can you imagine if that was the case today? Can you imagine by the implementation and the performance of that one statute alone, how much less crime there would be in our nation today. And as Herschel pointed out following last week's message, how much more so if every law-abiding, able-bodied man was also required to carry a firearm, like it is in, what is it, a town in Massachusetts somewhere, and the crime rate has de-escalated beyond their imaginations, to carry a firearm for the protection of himself and his family and his neighbors as well. Can you imagine, again, how much crime, how much less crime there would be in our nation? As it is today, not only is this statute not in force, but our government has, for the most part, taken the inherent right of protection away from today's men, except when the men have petitioned, or prayed to, is another word for petitioned, and jumped through the government hoops to secure a carry and conceal weapon. And by the way, don't forget, or a carry and conceal license in order to carry the weapon. And don't forget, the definition of a license is permission to do what to the government is otherwise illegal. That's what a license is. Because they made it illegal for everybody else. Now I'll license the special people that we'll sanction and we'll give our blessings to so that they might do so. Well, men, listen to me again. Two things. First, Yahweh has already given us permission. The Christian man, the Christian Israelite man. In fact, so much as commanded us even to be armed for protection against criminals. Has he not? There's several passages that can be used. One certainly that should come to mind is when he told the apostles to, you know, you don't have a sword, you better sell your robe. A sword's more important. Robes for protection. He says a sword's more protection. It's more protection than a robe's going to be. Sell your robe if you have to. Get a weapon. And of course, the sword then was equivalent to a six-shooter today or something maybe even better than that. And if you're not convinced that God has already given us permission, that we don't have to go and get sanction and permission and license from the government, if you're not yet convinced of this, and I would recommend to go to our website and go to the article page and read the article Firearms Scripturally Defended, and I think you'll have certainly enough evidence of that, and I don't think there's any problem with who I'm speaking to here, but possibly those who might hear in the tape ministry. If you're not convinced of it, I'd recommend that article. Secondly, men, armed or not, and we're not always armed. We're armed. You know, that can be a pretty good weapon. But even when we're not armed otherwise, we are still, don't miss this, we are still responsible to defend and protect not only our own families and property, but also our neighbors. And that's what those statutes last week were all about. In fact, according to 1 Timothy 5:8, we're worse than an infidel if we aren't prepared to do so, and we don't do so when the occasion calls for it. Or at the very least, you're no better than small, sad Sam. Now, somebody in Wisconsin who heard part 3 of A Man After Yahweh's Heart and my new rendition of Big Bad John emailed this to me. I didn't know there was a song that was written kind of the opposite of Big Bad John, and it's called Small, Sad Sam. Here's how it goes. Small, sad Sam. Small, sad Sam. Here's a tale of a man who was puny and weak, stood 4'6" in his stocking feet. Kind of narrow in the shoulder and heavy in the waist, everything about him seemed to be misplaced. Small Sam. Small, sad Sam. He slid into town one rainy night, running like a dog away from a fight. He had a pretty big mouth for a guy his size, and everything he said was a pack of lies. Small Sam. Small, sad Sam. One day he got on a downtown bus. First thing you know, there was an awful fuss. They threw Sam off into the street for trying to steal an old lady's seat. Bad Sam. Small, bad Sam. One day, nobody knows what for, an elevator stuck on the 85th floor. Some cables broke, and so it said that the car just hung there by a thread. The women were calm, and the men were balm, but Sam screamed and cried like a little child. He squeezed himself through the emergency door and pulled himself up to the 86th floor. Small Sam, Chicken Sam, Small Chicken Sam. And then instead of helping others get free, Sam said, "I'm looking out for me." The cable snapped, and all the way down, they cursed out Sam when they hit the ground. Small Sam, small, sad Sam. Now, someday Sam's going to get his due, and when he does, I'll make a bet with you. There ain't nobody gonna pass a hat, because Sam was nothing but a no-good cat. Small, sad Sam. Yes, small Sam, small sad Sam, chicken Sam, small sad Sam, no good Sam, small sad Sam, small sad Sam. At the worst, when we're not prepared to follow through with what God intends for us men, and I'm speaking to the men, for us to be the men that God has called us to be our own and our families and our possessions and our neighbors and even our enemies. Guardian and protector. And at the very best, we're nothing but a small, sad Sam. And at the worst, we're nothing better than an infidel. All right, with that, let's move on to another Eighth Commandment statute. We began this series talking about property in particular, how fundamental property is to the kingdom, to dominion, and particularly to both the fourth and the eighth commandments. And therefore, with that in mind, especially as it relates to the eighth commandment, you would expect that Yahweh would jealously guard property rights, and indeed he does. Let's take our Bibles now and turn to Deuteronomy chapter 19, and I want to read just verse 14. Verse 14, it says, "Thou shalt not remove thy neighbor's landmark, which they of old time have set in thine inheritance, which thou shalt inherit in the land that Yahweh thy God giveth thee to possess it." Now, you find essentially the same thing in Proverbs chapter 22:8. It says, "Remove not the ancient landmark, which thy fathers have set." Proverbs 23:10 renders it this way, "Remove not the old landmark, and enter not into the fields of the fatherless." And then along with some other forms of theft, this sin is also mentioned in Job 24:2. You can reread that on your own. Then also turn to Deuteronomy chapter 27 and verse 17. And already by the statute we find in Deuteronomy chapter 19, repeated twice in the Proverbs, mentioned once in Job, and then here again we're going to see that such a man who would do so is even cursed by Yahweh. You can see that indeed this is a particular statute that God paid special attention to, enough so that it's referred to at least five times in the Old Testament alone. Deuteronomy 27 and verse 17, we find this, and it says, "Cursed be he that removeth his neighbor's landmark, and all the people shall say amen." Now, this particular statute was especially pertinent in the days when there were no boundary fences that marked off someone's property, but only open ranges, which would have been the case in much of old Palestine when they first took over. And certainly here in America, in early American days, when there was nothing but open range. And therefore, the landmarks, the corner post, had to be set to mark off someone's property. And so it would have been much easier to someone to come along and start hedging those markers, and their land would expand wherever they did so, as the neighboring landowner's land would have slowly decreased as they continued to do so. Adam Clark comments on this. He says, "Before the extensive use of fences, land property was marked out by stones or posts, set up so as to ascertain the divisions of family estates. It was easy to remove one of these landmarks and set it in a different place, and thus the dishonest man enlarged his own estate by contracting that of his neighbors. The termini, or landmarks, among Romans were held very sacred," the landmarks themselves, and then it goes on, "and were at last deified themselves." The landmarks, that's how far, God doesn't go that far with it, but the Romans went as far as they were actually deified and became gods themselves. In fact, to the Romans, and you could see why they would do so, to move a landmark or a corner post was a capital crime. Well, if you deified them, you know, you could see why they would do so. Now, God doesn't go that far. This comes under the Eighth Commandment, and there's nothing under the Eighth Commandment that's a capital crime. But God did, nonetheless, make it a statute of the Eighth Commandment for obvious reasons. According to Calvin, he wrote this. He said that everyone's property may be secure, it is necessary that the landmarks set up for the division of fields should remain untouched. And then he said this, as if they were sacred. And indeed, they of course shouldn't be deified, but they should be sacred. They were sacred to God enough to say, you are not, you will be cursed. In fact, if you intend to move in any fashion someone's boundaries or landmarks. Let me read from Matthew Henry's commentary as well. He said this because he kind of amplifies upon it a little bit. He says, here is implicit direction given to the first planters of Canaan to fix landmarks according to the distribution of the land to the several tribes and families by lot. Note, it is the will of God that everyone, and don't miss this, should know his own and that all good means should be used to prevent encroachments and the doing and suffering of wrong. I missed this myself in this part. He said that everyone should know his own and that all good means should be used to prevent. A man has a right to protect his property. Again, many times, there are many passages that can be used to verify that. All good means should be used to prevent encroachments and the doing and suffering of wrong. Later he wrote, the invading of any man's right and taking to ourselves that which is not our own by any fraudulent arts and practices, as by forging, concealing, destroying, or altering deeds and writings, which are our landmarks to which appeals are made, or by shifting hedges, mere stones, and boundaries, though the landmarks were set by the hand of man, yet he was a thief and a robber by the law of God that removed them. End of that quote from Matthew Henry. Now, I wanted to share that with you because, again, in many of the statutes, in the way that they're stated, it's not the statute itself that needs to be given special attention to, but the principle of the statute. You know, in many cases, because they were an agricultural society, it talks about the theft of sheep or oxen or other livestock. Well, it obviously was to be meant to be taken and applied to other things as well, as we have in past messages in this series. The same with this. I believe there's a much broader application than sometimes what we want to think about in this particular statute, and sometimes into areas that go beyond the Eighth Commandment. In fact, remember that many statutes fit under more than one particular commandment. It may fit under two. It may fit under three or four of the different commandments because there's implication for more than just one commandment. Let's turn, for example, to Hosea now, chapter 5, to an interesting passage, at least when you start evaluating and applying it. Hosea chapter 5, and again, just one verse, verse 10. Listen to what this says. It says in Hosea 5 and verse 10, it says, the princes of Judah were like them that removed the bound, or New American Standard says the boundaries. Therefore, I will pour out my wrath upon them like water. Now, note that in this passage it says that the princes are like those who move the boundaries. In that case, I'm sure it's talking about the physical boundaries of somebody's land property. And he says the princes are like. Didn't say the princes were doing. Princes do that. Don't be mistaken about that. But in this case, he's talking about princes or rulers who were like those who moved the land boundaries. Now, how would a prince or a king or a president or a senator or a representative or a lower or high court justice be like those who move the boundaries, or the corner posts, or whatever you want to call them? Well, what was it that provided Israel with her boundaries in life? Look up the word boundaries in some thesauruses, and you'll find in some of them as a synonym, the word compass for boundary. Well, what is Israel's moral compass? It's our law. It's Yahweh's law, is it not? And therefore, when a ruler rules by anything other than Yahweh's laws, he is like one who has moved the boundaries. Hosea 8:4, maybe, since we just read from Hosea 5, Hosea 8:4 may give us some indication of that, where it says, they have set up kings, but not by me. Now, was God ultimately in control of that? Yeah, he was. Daniel makes that clear. Even the basest of kings he has control over. But from the people's perspective, they had set up kings, he said, but not by me. In other words, they weren't ruling in my power. They didn't have me in mind and my laws in mind. They set up kings, but not by me. And it says they have made princes, and I knew it not. Now, he obviously knew it, but they just weren't the kind of men that he intended to have as rulers over Israel. Also, Jeremiah 5 and verse 31, it says, the prophets prophesy falsely, and the priest or other rulers, the priests were the pretty much the civil rulers of that day, so we're still talking civil rulers here, the priests rule on their own authority. The law has been thrown out, and now the priests are ruling on their own authority. And then it says, probably the worst part of that particular verse is it says, and the people love to have it so. For a while. See, that only lasts for a while. It's like 2 Timothy 4 that says that they're looking for leaders, preachers, teachers, pastors who will tickle the ears. Well, sooner or later, that tickling catches up to you, and it's no longer you're no longer being tickled because you're not being blessed by the word as God intends it to be. And it's the same when ministers, and of course ministers is used in England still, talking about civil rulers, when civil rulers rule on their own authority, the people love to have it so, for a while. Proverbs chapter 29 and verse 2 says, when the righteous increase, the people rejoice. But when a wicked man rules, people groan. So sooner or later it catches up. Yes, for a while, the people love to have it so, but not without a price, because in so doing, their inheritance in Yahweh is eventually robbed from them by such preachers. Man, have we been robbed because they've moved the boundaries that God had set for us. Consider also what today's Supreme Court justices are doing as it concerns the Constitution. Are they not also like those who move the boundaries by reinterpreting the Constitution rather than just applying and enforcing the Constitution as it was intended? Are they not moving the boundaries? It's a fact, isn't it? That's what's happening. That's another way to interpret that they're moving the boundaries. It's a fact, but be careful. Because the Constitution is neither our compass or the standard for us, is it? You know, and some people are all upset because they're moving the boundaries. They are. And granted, what they're moving it to now is a whole lot worse than what they had intended in the 1700s, but that's not the standard. You see, the founding fathers themselves also moved the boundaries when they wrote the Constitution. Because we, Israel, already had a constitution. The Bible. God's Word. Particularly His laws. That's the standard we have to go back to. The Constitution. I mean, as good as it was, and it's going to be hard for people to accept this once again, as good as it was, it still was only man's best. Or the best he's come up with to date. Who wants man's best? That's still imperfection. We want God's best. And so even the constitutionalists have moved the boundaries. And as it was at Patrick Henry who said, or one of the men said, you know, this is what's going to happen. He foretold where we are today was that the Constitution would get us right here. That it would be abused and misused. This also applies to, of course, to today's antinomian preachers. And in fact, they too have not only removed Israel's compass or boundaries, but they are ultimately responsible, are they not, for our politicians and our judges doing the same. And again, I've said this at other times, we have a tendency to point our finger, a nasty finger over at Capitol Hill or Crime Hill today, but it's went from Capitol Hill to Crime Hill because the men behind the pulpits are no longer the men that we once had in this nation in the 1600s and 1700s. There was no way that the politicians in those days would have got away with what they did because of the preachers that filled America's pulpits. How about today's educators? Are they not also like those who move the boundaries, the compass of our children? And not only as it concerns morality, the Puritan ethic that was once the roots or the founding of our country, but also both as it concerns our Christian and our Israelite history. They've moved the boundaries. And so people aren't even, our children are being raised without the knowledge that we even began as a Christian nation, let alone that many here in this nation in the beginnings, at least in their hearts understood, if not mentally understood, that we were Israel. They've moved the boundaries. Once again, they've stolen from the hearts and the minds of our people. Young people, be careful with that you don't reject your parents' ways, especially when founded on the Word. Just because they appear to you to be old fogies and their ways seem to be archaic. Now, I haven't got to that age where I'm yet looking like I'm an old fogey, at least I hope. Well, probably am. But you don't have to nod so readily back there. But be careful. And in fact, Israel best be careful as well that she doesn't do the same as it concerns the way of our forefathers. Especially as during those times when it was founded upon the Word, upon the laws of Yahweh. Too late, isn't it? It's already happened. But it's not too late for them to return to what they rejected. As Yahweh recorded in Jeremiah 6:16 when he said, "Thus saith Yahweh, stand by the ways and see and ask for the new paths." Isn't that what our youth want? They want the new ways. Well, go back and read that verse, and it doesn't say that at all. He said, "Stand by the ways and see and ask for the ancient paths." Where the boundary markers, where you had a boundary set out for you. And then he said, "Where the good way is, and walk in it, and you shall find rest for your souls." Look for Yahweh's boundary markers, and keep yourselves within them, and don't let anybody move them, whether it be the markers for our land, or the markers in these other regards as well. The statute in Deuteronomy 19:14 is, of course, the basis, when we come back to the land issue there, is the basis of our surveying system. However, I've been told by two different surveyors that get the messages that because our modern surveyor is bureaucratically controlled today, that even modern surveying has been corrupted to a certain point. One area where I can assure you that the government has broken this statute in Deuteronomy 19:14 of moving the boundary markers is in the government's claim to eminent domain. Eminent domain is the so-called government's right to take what property it wants for the quote-unquote betterment or quote-unquote best of the people as a whole. Here's Bouvier's Law Dictionary's definition of this. Eminent domain, the superior right of property. Now, listen carefully to all that this says. The superior right of property subsisting in a sovereignty by which private property may in certain cases be taken or its use controlled for the public benefit without regard to the wishes of the owner. Now, what's that sound like to you? Going on, the power to take private property for public use. And then a little bit later, the right of every government to appropriate otherwise than by taxation and its police authority, which are distinct powers, private property for public use. Don't miss, that definition provides three different ways by which the government is stealing from us. Taxation, police authority, and eminent domain. Eminent domain, of course, is just, it's nothing in this case, but a fancy word for legalized theft or plunder. I mean, let's go back and read that first sentence again. The superior right of a of property subsisting in a sovereignty by which the private property may in certain cases be taken or its use controlled for the public benefit without regard to the wishes of the owner. And I'm wondering why it just didn't say the superior right of property subsisting in a sovereignty by which private property is stolen. That's what it says. Of course, they wouldn't write that in the definition. Eminent domain, in the way that governments use it, is just a fancy word for legalized theft or plunder. Furthermore, because only, and I don't know if you caught this or not, but because only Yahweh is sovereign, let me go back, the superior right of property subsisting in a sovereignty. Therefore, because only Yahweh is sovereign, is there anyone who's sovereign? I mean, sometimes the patriots will claim to be, we're a sovereign citizen. In that sense, possibly, but we know there is ultimately only one who is indeed sovereign over all. And because only Yahweh is sovereign and holds eminent domain, or title is another word for that, to all land, we're told that time and time again, that all the earth belongs to him. Therefore, any government claiming eminent domain is not only breaking the Eighth Commandment when it enforces that claim, but it or they who run government are also breaking the First Commandment by making themselves out to be God. Any claim to eminent domain other than Yahweh's is simply a claim that we are now God. Now, I intend to address eminent domain in a little more detail as we get a little bit further into this series. But suffice it to say that there is no exception clause found in Deuteronomy 19:14 or anywhere else as concerns moving the boundary markers. And therefore, no one individual or collective body of people, call it government or otherwise, has the right to steal your land by moving the landmarks or the boundary markers of your property, no matter how good the excuse or the reason may sound. And let me tell you, the government can come up with some awfully good sounding excuses for taking property from you, for expanding a highway or running a highway down through your land, and doing, you know, you don't want to sell? You don't have a choice. Sell, or they just simply take it from you. It's simply called theft, and there is no exception clause found therein that gives them the right to do that. Another way that boundaries are removed is found in Isaiah chapter 5. Let's turn there if you would. Isaiah chapter 5, and let's start with verse 7. It's verse 8 that we want to concentrate on, but kind of get the flavor of what's going on here. In verse 7, it says, Isaiah 5, verse 7, it says, "For the vineyard of Yahweh of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah his pleasant plant. And he looketh for judgment, and behold oppression for righteousness, but behold a cry." With that in mind, so we're talking, he's not finding the righteousness, the justice that he wants in his people. And with that in mind, he then says in verse 8, he says, "Woe unto them that join house to house, that lay field to field, till there be no place, that they may be placed alone in the midst of the earth." Another passage similar to that one is found in Micah chapter 2, verses 1 and 2. And there it says, "Woe to them that devise iniquity and work evil upon their beds. When the morning is light, they practice it because it is in the power of their hand." Verse 2, "And they covet fields and take them by violence and houses and take them away, so they oppress a man in his house, even a man in his heritage," his inheritance that was to be his. Should make you, we'll talk about this in another later message as well, but as I finish that second verse of Micah chapter 2, I can't help but think of Ahab and Naboth's vineyard and how he took it by violence. But also, you know, you read those two passages, Isaiah chapter 5 and Micah chapter 2, it sounds somewhat like modern banking practices. If you think of sometimes the end result, I know some of you here have had personal experience. But there's more here than just what's applicable to banking. Whether by usurious banking practices or by whatever means it might be accomplished, houses and lands are not to be amassed into the hands of a few or one. according to Isaiah chapter 5, verse 8. According to Isaiah chapter 5, verse 8, I'd say Ted Turner's got some answering to do, and a whole lot of others as well. But God says it's not to be to happen. According to Yahweh's law, land was to be, first of all, equitably divided amongst the tribes of Israel, and then amongst the families of each tribe. In other words, when it comes to homes and lands, there was to be equality among the families of Israel. All were to have a lot of land. Or I'm not so sure that necessarily all were to have it, but at least the firstborn, the patriarch, therefore then the patriarch in waiting, was to have the land, and often others of the family would maybe be living in either on the land or possibly in the cities as well, if that was their choice. But there was to be an equitable division of the land amongst the families of Israel. Furthermore, land grants were to always remain in the hands of the family of the original owner. Now, someone, you can almost hear it, someone's going to object to that. And they're going to say, they're going to declare, but what about new immigrants? Well, therein is indeed a point that is often overlooked concerning Yahweh's land grants. Now, they're asking the question from the opposite perspective of the one I'm going to take here. It's a good question, and it should make us realize what God intends. Think about it. The way in which Israel's land was allotted automatically regulated, controlled, and even stifled foreign immigration. Did it not? In other words, unlike today in modern America, except for possibly temporary visas, there was nothing for foreign immigrants to come to Israel's land for. A job, maybe. Temporary work, temporary visa. But there was nothing for them to come for, because the land was exclusively Israel's and had already been divided amongst Israel, and was to all, God made provision that it was always to remain in Israel's hands. Yes, that's right. Let's carry it a little further. Yahweh was and is a separatist. Wasn't a nasty word to God. It's only become a nasty word to our politically correct society and a quote-unquote Christian world that no longer has thrown out God's laws and no longer takes his position on almost anything. Yahweh was a separatist, a segregationist. How do you say apartheid in that sense? Apartheidist? You know, if you want to look at it from the South Africa point of view. That's what he was. Turn, let's New Testament, Acts chapter 17. Now, it's interesting. Acts 7, the verse I'm going to read to you is verse 24 that we're going to read together. Acts 17, 24 is read and used a lot today. In fact, there's a book that's recently come out called One Blood by Ken Ham and Carl Wieland, W-I-E-L-A-N-D, no relation. That's based on the first half of this verse. And let me say, a distorted position on this verse, because the entirety of God, the sum of God's word, was never taken into account when it came to this verse. And the interpretation, the book is suspect just from its interpretation to begin with. The first half of this verse, in some cases, it's interesting, we're going to find the word one blood in this, but the word blood is not in all the ancient manuscripts. In some versions, it's just from one, which puts a whole different perspective on this verse, and much more that puts a different perspective on this verse as well. But you'll often hear the first half of verse 24 read and centered on and attention given to, and completely ignore what comes thereafter and the implications thereof. Acts 17, verse 24. Whoops, that's not right. 26, thank you. And it says in verse 26, "And has made of one blood," King James Version, New American Standard doesn't even use the word blood there, but nevertheless, let's not get hung up on that. "And has made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on all the face of the earth, and has," then it says, "and has determined the times before appointed and the bounds. Back right back to the boundary markers, aren't we? In this case, bigger boundary markers, because we're talking about the land inheritance of nations. But it says, and has determined the times before appointed and the bounds or the boundaries of all of these different nations' habitations. Now, nearly everyone again today is focusing on the first part of that verse without ever, well, completely ignoring the implications of the second part of the verse. And that is that the fact that Yahweh set bounds, boundaries for the races, the different races and their nations. It couldn't be any clearer than right there. Now, how did he do that? What was his guide, if you will, for on what nations got what? We won't turn there. You probably already know where I'm going. But Deuteronomy 32:8, which is where what this is referring to, this Acts 17:26 verse. In Deuteronomy 32:8, it says, "And when the Most High divided the nations their inheritance, when He separated," you could put in segregated there just as easily. "And when He separated the sons of Adam, He set bounds of the people according to the number of the children of Israel." So He did so according to what He gave to Israel. He gave Israel their land first. He said, "This is what is yours, and everybody else is to be segregated." Was God a segregationist? You better believe He was. Why? Why would He do that? Well, first of all, because He didn't create everybody brown. If He'd want everybody brown, He'd have created everybody brown. And secondly, He knew that there are nothing but problems when you try to integrate the different nations. He said, so it's best for everybody. The cultures will continue. The different peoples I've created will continue. And so don't fall for the lie that it's hateful to be a segregationist. You know, it's the integrationists who eventually, their idea for the world eventually destroys the races. So which is hateful? Now, back to Israel's land inheritance and the fact that such promoted segregation or restricted integration, depending upon from which perspective you want to look at it. Interesting, again, although often overlooked, this is one of the reasons why Ezra and Nehemiah condemned Israel's mixing with the forbidden lineages. Even to the point, forbid it, and even to the point of sending away the wives and children of these mixed marriages. We may not get through all of this, but let's go to Ezra chapter 9. I say we may not get through it because I want to read most of this chapter and a little bit of 10. It's not an extremely long chapter, but I want you to try to catch, there are three reasons given by Ezra why he saw that the people had to be segregated. Ezra chapter 9, let's begin with verse 1. It says, "And now these things were done. The princes came to me, saying, the people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves from the people of the lands, doing according to their abominations, even of the Canaanites and the Hittites," and skip over those several different nations that are mentioned there. Verse 2, "For they have taken of their daughters for themselves." They've intermarried with these people. "And for their sons, so that the holy seed have mingled themselves with the people of those lands. Yea, the hand of the princes and rulers hath been chief in this trespass. And when I heard this thing," now listen to how what it did to Ezra. Oh, that we had preachers behind the pulpits today who would be as concerned over this sin as Ezra was. He says, "And when I heard this thing, I rent my garment and my mantle and plucked off the hair of my head. And my beard, and sat down astonished. You know, he literally pulled the hair out of his head. Now, I think Nehemiah had the better idea. You go read out what Nehemiah's reaction was. He went and pulled the hair out of their heads. Herschel, you're safe. All right, that's how concerned he was over this issue. Verse 4, or let's jump down to verse 5. "And at the evening sacrifice, I rose up from my heaviness, and having rent my garment and my mantle, I fell upon my knees and spread out my hands unto Yahweh my God." I mean, this guy is serious about this. He's going before God, going to confess his sin and the sin of the people, and said, "Oh my God, I am ashamed, and I blush to lift up my face to Thee, my God." Oh, Ted, don't preach on miscegenation again, man. with the way it's become so rampant in this country today, we better be preaching on it. We better get it across to our young people that this is absolutely forbidden, condemned, and outrages our God. Ezra, this is a scribe of the Lord. He was lauded for being one who practiced the law of Yahweh. We're going to see it has to do with the law of Yahweh. He goes on, for our iniquities are increased over our head and our trespasses grown up under the heavens. How much more so today as it regards this sin of integration and miscegenation? Since the days of our fathers have we been in great trespass unto this day, and for our iniquities have we, our kings and our priests, been delivered unto the hand of the kings of the lands. He's talking about this intermixing with forbidden lineages with its extension to other races. To the sword and to captivity and to the spoil and to the confusion of face as it is this day. This was the result of their sin, he said. And now for a little space, grace has been showed from Yahweh our God to leave us a remnant, to escape and to give us a nail in his holy place, that our God may lighten our eyes and give us a little reviving in our bondage. He was talking about that. There's this little space of time that God has now taken those from the Babylonian captivity after the 70 years of captivity and allowed us to come back and rebuild the Jerusalem, and particularly the temple, and therefore to reestablish the laws of Yahweh in the land. And he's saying, we've got this little space of time. Let's not blow it. Jump down to verse 10. And now our God, what shall we say after this? For we have forsaken thy commandments. He's talking about miscegenation here, or at least in this case, forbidden lineages, which is essentially one and the same thing. Because keep in mind, although all of the race, all of the nations mentioned here are of the same white race as Israel was, don't think that it has been any different. I mean, the blacks and the Chinese and the Japanese weren't in the area yet. Had they been there, do you think it had been any different with Ezra? He's just dealing with the nations that are prominent there at the time. Okay, and I'm running out of time. Forsake thy commandments, verse 10, which thou hast commanded by thy servants the prophets, saying, the land unto which you go to possess it, it is an unclean land, filthiness and so forth and so on, verse 12. Now therefore, give not your daughters, according to the commandments, he says, these are the commandments you've forsaken. And he says, give not your daughters unto their sons, neither take their daughters unto your sons, nor seek their peace or their wealth forever, that you may be strong and eat the good of the land and leave it for an inheritance to your children forever. And after all that has come upon us for our evil deeds and for our great trespass, seeing that our God has punished us less than our iniquities deserve, don't miss that, and has given us such deliverance as this that they now had at that moment, should we again break thy commandments? Should we do what caused us to go into captivity in the first place? And join in affinity with the people of these abominations? Wouldest not thou be angry with us till thou hast consumed us, so that there should be no remnant nor escaping? Just a thought I just had. Maybe they didn't have to worry about God consuming them, because if they continued in the sin, they would consume themselves, would they not? Because they would lose what they were by mixing. Verse 15, O Yahweh, God of Israel, thou art righteous, for we remain yet escaped as it is this day. Behold, we are before thee in our trespasses, for we cannot stand before thee because of this. And then in verse 10, now when Ezra had prayed, and when he had confessed, weeping and casting himself down before the house of God, there assembled unto him out of Israel a very great congregation of men and women and children, for the people wept very sore. And Shechaniah, the son of Jehiel, one of the sons of Elam, answered and said unto Ezra, we have trespassed against our God and have taken strange wives of the people of the land, yet now there is hope in Israel concerning this thing. Now therefore, let us make a covenant with our God to put away all the wives and such as are born of them, according to the counsel of my Lord and of those that tremble at the commandment of our God, and let it be done according to the law. Now, I mentioned that we're not going to have time. If you want to hear how there's three reasons, not one, because in today's churches today, everybody will say it was all because of the religious effect. But there are three reasons given in that passage. If you didn't catch them as I went through it, you might want to go back and read it again. There are three reasons why Ezra said this is not to be done. Four reasons, excuse me. Number one, and most important, was that it was against the commandment of God. But there are more, and it ties back in with Isaiah chapter 5, ties back in with Deuteronomy chapter 19, 14, and moving the boundary marks. We'll come back to that in the next message. I was hoping to get through that, but we just ran out of time, too much ad-libbing, and hopefully even the ad-libbing was good enough to stretch it out a little bit further than what I anticipated. Anyway, we'll come back. We'll find out what those three reasons are if you haven't figured it out on your own. Let's stand and we'll close this in prayer. Heavenly Father, we are thankful again. Praise and glorify you for all that you are, all that you do, and all that you've given and blessed us with. Particularly, Father, that you've given us guidelines, boundaries, that you've given us a compass for our lives found in your commandments, statutes, and judgments. Help us as a people, Lord, Father, to recognize how good it is that you've done this with us, that you've given us something that's perfect, and that anything that we would do to substitute it is just imperfect at the best, and usually much worse than that. Bless our people, open our hearts and minds to you, to your Son, and Father, to your laws. Let them be the way markers, the guideposts. Let them be the ancient landmarks that we return to in returning this nation, Father, unto you. We praise you now and glorify you for these things, and it's in Yeshua the Christ that we pray. Amen.